Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we continue with our two-part interview with James Loewen, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong, and Lies Across America, What Our Historic Sites Get Wrong. Last week, Loewen talked about the myths and errors in our textbooks. This week, he takes a look at our historic sites. And David Greenberg will be joining us to provide some historical perspective on the controversy surrounding Judge Alfred Goodwin's recent decision that recitation of the phrase "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance in the public schools is unconstitutional. But first, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on March 24, 1977, the United States and Cuba, two Cold War enemies, engaged in diplomatic negotiations for the first time since severing ties in 1961. Soon after coming to power in 1959, Cuban leader Fidel Castro embraced the Soviet bloc and moved further and further away from the U.S., despite being only 90 miles off the coast of Florida. Nearly two decades of tense relations ensued until 1977, when President Jimmy Carter proposed that the U.S. and Cuba enter into negotiations over fishing rights. The historic meeting took place on March 24, 1977, in New York City, but the negotiations did not focus solely on fishing rights. Castro agreed to release some political prisoners, and Carter said he would permit limited travel to Cuba. They even agreed to establish embassies of sorts, or, quote, interest sections, in each other's countries. Opposition arose almost immediately. The Cuban-American community protested closer ties with the dictator, whose leadership many had fled, and even Carter's advisors grew concerned with his perceived softness on Cuba. When the pro-American leaders of Nicaragua and Iran fell, followed by the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, President Carter's hand was forced, and he adopted a less conciliatory tone with Castro. When Castro sent over 10,000 troops to participate in the war in Angola, all negotiations with Cuba ended.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, Mormon history has been in the news lately, and it hasn't been good news. First, anthropologist Thomas Murphy, himself a Mormon, set out to test a key principle in his Mormon faith. He used DNA analysis to see if the teaching in the Book of Mormon that many American Indians are descended from the ancient Israelites was correct. He found that it wasn't. And when he made the results public, church leaders threatened to excommunicate him. A hearing was scheduled but postponed, one leader explained, because it was not the best time to proceed. And on September 11, 1857, a group of California-bound pioneers camping in southern Utah was murdered by a Mormon militia and its American Indian allies. The whole United States rang with its horrors, Mark Twain recalled years later. Church leaders denied responsibility, blaming instead the Indians and a rogue church official. But two new books find Mormon prophet Brigham Young responsible for organizing the killings and then conspiring to cover up his role. He did it, says Will Bagley in his book Blood of the Prophets. He was an absolute dictator, Sally Denton adds, the author of American Massacre, The Tragedy at Mountain Meadows. Nothing happened except under his direct orders. Spokesman for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints vehemently rejects the conclusion and promises their own published account of the massacre in 2004. This is Talking History. Ever thought about the politics of interpreting historic sites, determining what you can tell visitors that the public will find acceptable if it's a publicly supported site, or that donors will approve of if they're paying the bills? James Loewen has, and he has found some very interesting, if incorrect, views of history. In his second part of his interview with Fred Nielsen of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, Lowen talks about what our historic sites get wrong.
In his book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, my guest James Lowen examined the failings of American history textbooks. Lowen then turned his attention to historic sites, traveling across the country to study historical markers, monuments, museums, houses, forts, and ships. What he found is the subject of his book, Lies Across America, What Our Historic Sites Get Wrong. Professor Lowen, welcome back.
Thank you, Fred.
Your book is filled with some wonderful anecdotes. Some of my favorite involve the improbable story of Abraham Lincoln's cabin. Could you tell us about that?
Yes. I actually began with the famous student blooper, which I tracked down. It was set at the University of Wisconsin in something like 1915, and it goes, Abraham Lincoln was born in a log cabin that he built with his own hands. Well, it turns out that that's not true. According to the National Park Service in Hodgdonville, Kentucky, Abraham Lincoln was born in this log cabin, which they show us there, enshrined in a little Greek temple. And it turns out that log cabin was built in 1895, 30 years after Lincoln's death. Now, this cabin had a remarkable story. In about 1895, some entrepreneur bought the farm, I speak literally, bought the Sinking Spring farm where Lincoln was born, and also bought the services of a man on site whose job it was to go find a cabin and put it up on the farm. The real cabin had fallen down before Lincoln was ever president. And so he gets this cabin, puts it up on the farm. There's a local reporter asks him, now, is this the real cabin? And the agent said something like, Abraham Lincoln were born in a log cabin, weren't he? One cabin's as good as another. So they put this cabin on the farm. Now, this is before the invention of the automobile. It is when there's not any paved roads, and Hodgdonville is not on the road anywhere, so hardly anybody came to see it. So our entrepreneur had his agent ship the cabin off to what really amounted to a World's Fair, the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo, New York. And he exhibited there next to Jefferson Davis's log cabin. Now, Jefferson Davis wasn't even born in a log cabin, but never mind. The two cabins were there with little signs, and they even hired the services of some local African Americans to pose as slaves. And it was one of the most popular exhibits at the Pan American Exposition. So when the exposition closed around 1900 or so, our man shipped the two cabins down to Coney Island to put them on display. But alas, on the train, the two cabins got commingled, and so when they put them up at Coney Island, it was just one big cabin. Didn't deter him. He put up a sign saying the Lincoln-Davis log cabin. And presumably both of the presidents were born there, although on separate days. He then took the Lincoln cabin, cut back down in size, and shipped it off to Kentucky, and for a while it was in the state capital, I believe. And then he hired the farm got sold to Robert Collier, the owner of Collier's Magazine, a famous competitor of the Saturday Evening Post back then. He bought the farm, he bought the cabin, and he also bought the services of a well-known American architect, John Russell Pope. And he hired Pope to build an acceptable enclosure. So Pope built this little Greek temple. Looks kind of like a little Parthenon. And he put the cabin in it, only to make the discovery that he had miscalculated, that walking around inside the temple but outside the cabin, it was just too scrunchy. And so he knew just what to do. He cut the cabin down. So now this cabin is about two-thirds the size it used to be, two-thirds the size of Lincoln's, two-thirds the size of any normal pioneer cabin. But ironically, it only makes for a bigger story. And I quote a fairly recent New York Times story talking about how the juxtaposition of the cabin and the Greek temple just show the amazing upward mobility of the Lincoln family because it was such a little cabin. So that's the story. The National Park Service doesn't tell that story, though. In fact, they have a sign that says, Traditional Birthplace Cabin of Abraham Lincoln, which I think gives tradition a new meaning. It now means hoax over time. Furthermore, they will actually, if you ask them, they will give you a handout with the dimensions of the hoax cut-down cabin so you can go build one of your own, and a bunch of people have done so, including the Lincoln Life Insurance Company over in Indiana. Only if you specifically ask them will they tell you, yeah, this cabin probably isn't real, probably isn't the cabin that Abraham Lincoln had anything to do with.
So I could tell my neighbors that Lincoln was born in my own backyard, if I play it right?
At least one person built the cabin in his backyard, in her backyard, actually.
Well, there are other examples, too. According to an exhibit brochure in Philadelphia, there are few American ships that participated in as many crucial world events as the USS Olympia. And yet it turns out that the exhibit leaves out much of that vessel's history.
Yeah, the Olympia is on display in Philadelphia, and it's a really important ship because of its role in two wars. One was the Philippines War, the Spanish-American War leading into the Philippines War, and the other was our war with the Soviet Union between 1918 and 1920, and it doesn't really tell about either of them. In fact, almost no place on the American landscape is there any description of either of those wars, which makes the failure at the Olympia, the failure to tell about the past, all the more tragic. All across the United States, we have these statues to, well, they're allegedly to the Spanish-American War. Almost every one of them, not quite every one, says Spanish-American War, 1898-1902. Now, the Spanish-American War lasted 3 months. So how does it get 5 years? Well, the answer is that these are not really for the Spanish-American War. They're really for our war against the Philippines. Now, the Filipinos were our ally, of course, against Spain. And this is the first role that this ship played. The Filipinos had taken all of the Philippines, with the exception of Manila, from the Spanish, and they were encroaching on Manila. They had already taken its water supply. It was just a question of time before the Spanish would have to surrender to them. But the Spanish much preferred to surrender to the United States, thus they're surrendering to a white, more or less European power, rather than to these colonial people that they had been ruling for centuries. So after a sham battle that had been arranged between the Olympia and Dewey and the Spanish surrendered to the United States. And for some months, the United States occupies Manila, and the Filipinos occupy the rest of their country and proclaim independence and so on. And then, in the suburbs of Manila, we attacked them. And the result was a war that maybe is the longest war in American history, depends on how you measure it, maybe longer than the Vietnam War. And it had many parallels to the Vietnam War, even to the extent of we based our successes on body counts, we called the other side gooks, and so on. And we know nothing about it. In fact, during the war in Vietnam, it would have been an important war to know about because it was such a close parallel. But I was around and even active during the war in Vietnam, didn't know a thing about it, neither did most other people. And I think it's because at this ship, as at the Spanish-American War monuments all across the country, the history of the Philippines War has been deliberately mystified. And then we get to this other war. I was 42 years old before I first realized that the United States had put troops into Russia in 1918, trying to help the whites defeat the Reds in the Russian Civil War. And the Olympia, it turned out, played a key role up by Norway, bringing troops to Murmansk and Archangel up there. We also put troops in Vladivostok. They went all the way to Lake Baikal in the middle of Siberia. And it was our first secret undeclared war. That is, Woodrow Wilson kept it secret from Congress. Of course, gradually the truth came out about it. It was a terribly stupid endeavor, and it just led to hundreds of casualties, and we didn't get anywhere, partly because the side we were in favor of, the whites, were even more morally bankrupt than the Reds proved to be. So this history, too, is essentially ignored. There's one tiny little exhibit that shows a couple of things with no explanation in a little cabinet. You could never learn the history of our intervention in Russia from the Olympia.
You also visited sites devoted to James Buchanan, the 15th president, and Helen Keller, which you found ignored things that were rather important in their lives. And in different ways, you out both Buchanan and Helen Keller.
Yes. Often you go to a historic home, such as Wheatlands, which is Buchanan's home in Pennsylvania, or Helen Keller's home in North Alabama, and you come away actually stupider about the famous person whose home it was than when you went there. And I think that's the case at those two places. I usually make it a practice to just take the tour and not announce who I am, of course, just like a restaurant critic, you know, doesn't go into a restaurant and saying, well, I'm a famous restaurant critic, now how's your food? And then at the end of the tour, I usually ask a couple of questions. And at Buchanan's house, the video we saw first, the tour, just mystified everything that he was about. The video just barely mentioned that he was even a Democrat, and that was it. So at the end of the tour, I asked two short questions. One of them was he gay? And our tour director, who was a staff member of the museum, specifically replied, no, he was not, and then took us to the top of the stairs and showed us a picture in an oval frame of Buchanan's betrothed, a woman he was engaged to for 2 or 3 months when he was in his early 20s, I think it was. And this was to show that he was not gay. Well, it turned out, of course, that she actually broke off the engagement with him because, as a friend of hers put it, he could not seem to show her proper affection. And so she thought he was just into the relationship for her money, and she was from a rich family. It's a tragic story. She later more or less killed herself, supposedly, over this matter. Well, that's their answer to was he gay. He actually was gay. He was not openly gay, but he was further out of the closet than most people would ever think. He lived openly with a senator from Alabama, William Rufus King, briefly vice president even. And King was, being a senator from Alabama, was a member of the far-out pro-slavery wing of the Democratic Party, slave owner himself. And Buchanan, I quote, as looking up to King and thinking he's a wonderful fellow. And this leads us to the other question I asked. I said, how was he on slavery? And our person answered, he was against it. All of the people in this area were. Well, the guy's absolutely right about the area. The area is full of Mennonites and Quakers and Amish to this day, the most anti-slavery groups in America. But he's absolutely wrong. In fact, he's lying about Buchanan. Buchanan was so pro-slavery that his own church, the Presbyterians, disbarred him from communion for it. And I think the two lies tie together. I think that explains, that is, the gay relationship explains why Buchanan was so pro-slavery. But in any case, you end up stupider about Buchanan's private life and stupider about his public life. And you really do the same thing with Helen Keller. Helen Keller, of course, was not gay or lesbian, but she was a radical leftist. She got interested as she got her Radcliffe education, quite an accomplishment for a blind and deaf woman. She got interested in the problem of equity across America because she became aware that blindness was not distributed randomly around the social structure, but was concentrated in the lower class, both for reasons of inadequate medical care and also because of industrial accidents and so on that particularly afflicted poor people. So she became a socialist, and in fact, she then more or less became a communist, and was one throughout the rest of her life. And there's a whole book edited by Philip Foner, I think it is, of her left-wing writings and speeches. She was also a fan of the NAACP, which is quite a step for a woman born in Alabama, after all. So you go to her house, it actually flies a Confederate flag, and it says nothing at all about her social views, either in terms of socialism or in terms of her racial views. So, again, I think you end up stupider about Helen Keller when you leave the site than when you go there.
Why are so many sites then incomplete or misleading or wrong or in some cases even offensive? What explains that?
I think a lot of people who run small museums and small historical sites want to put the best foot forward for their community. They don't want to say anything that might embarrass their town, and they want to give viewers a feel-good experience. And I think they're basically misguided, particularly those who do so in order to be popular. If you look around the United States today, the most popular museum, and it has been for 12 years, is the Holocaust Museum here in Washington, D.C. This museum still has lines. You still have to get tickets ahead of time. They're free tickets, but you have to get them ahead of time to get in, 12 years after it opened. And it is simply not a feel-good museum. Now, admittedly, it's not our Holocaust. It's their Holocaust, so we don't have the problem of having to deal with a problem in our own society, although the museum does touch on the fact that the United States was not welcoming to Jewish refugees from Hitler's regime in the 1930s and into the 40s. But I think there's other examples, and the one I usually cite, the Museum of the Confederacy in Richmond, surely has one of the most conservative clienteles of any museum in the United States, one of even the most racist, we might say. And yet, 10 or 12 years ago, they put out an exhibit called Before Freedom Came that was a searching exploration of slavery before and during the Confederacy. And what happened? Well, I'll tell you. they got it, this exhibit drew four times as many people as any other exhibit they've ever had. So I really think that the United States people are ready for truth at historical museums, at historic markers and monuments. I think it's unfortunate that some of the people who run these museums and put up these markers and monuments aren't ready to give it to them.
Well, Professor Lowen, thanks so much for talking with us.
My time's up. That's too bad. I have lots more lies to talk about.
It's a never-ending supply.
Yeah.
I've been visiting with James Lowen, the author of Lies Across America, What Our Historic Sites Get Wrong.
Poor Alfred Goodwin, writes our guest commentator this week. So torrential was the flood of condemnation that followed his opinion, which held that it is unconstitutional for public schools to require students to recite Under God as part of the Pledge of Allegiance, that the beleaguered appellate court judge suspended his own ruling until the whole Ninth Circuit Court has a chance to review the case. Well, perhaps it's time to provide a bit of historical background on the subject, or so David Greenberg believes. Greenberg is a visiting scholar at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Months after a California judge ruled that it's unconstitutional for public schools to make students recite the words Under God as part of the Pledge of Allegiance, the controversy persists. It's a shame because the swelling presence of religion in American public life is both unnecessary and untrue to the nation's ideals. America's founders opposed the institutionalization of religion. The Constitution mentions religion only to guarantee that godly belief would never be a qualification for holding office. When Benjamin Franklin proposed, during the Constitutional Convention, that the drafters start each day with a prayer, his suggestion was defeated. The original Pledge of Allegiance, too, was meant as an expression of patriotism, not religious faith. It was written in 1892 by a socialist, Francis Bellamy, and made no mention of God. But during the Red Scare, religiosity overran Washington. Under the false notion that what distinguished the United States from Russia was theological, President Eisenhower inaugurated that Washington staple, the prayer breakfast. Congress added the words, "In God we trust," to all paper money. Proposed constitutional amendments wanted to affirm that Americans obeyed, quote, the authority and law of Jesus Christ. In this climate, the Catholic Fraternal Society, the Knights of Columbus, adopted the God-infused version of the pledge for their own meetings. Its members bombarded Congress with calls for the U.S. to do the same. In April 1953, a Michigan congressman formally proposed altering the pledge. The next year, the pastor of Eisenhower's Presbyterian Church gave a sermon, with a president in attendance, urging the inclusion of Under God in the pledge as a rebuke to godless communists. With Ike's backing, the idea sailed through Congress. The president signed the bill on Flag Day, rejoicing that millions of school children would daily proclaim their dedication to the Almighty. This history shows that the California judge was correct. The words Under God were not an innocuous insertion, but a deliberate attempt to endorse religion by the state, something the Supreme Court has deemed unconstitutional. How should the controversy be resolved? 40 years ago, another court decision held that it's unconstitutional for public schools to allow even a voluntary, non-denominational prayer. To those who felt religion was being threatened, President John F. Kennedy replied that there was a very easy remedy. Not a constitutional amendment, but a renewed commitment, he said, by Americans to pray at home, in their churches, and with their families.
You've been listening to David Greenberg, a visiting scholar at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and the author of Nixon's Shadow, The History of an Image. His commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Network. This is Talking History. finally, for our site of the week, we alert you to an interesting historical exhibit that may be coming to a museum near you and to which you might want to take the whole family. Here to tell you about it is Fiona Beat.
It's moving.
The American Library Association, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the National Library of Medicine has organized a traveling exhibit titled Frankenstein, Penetrating the Secrets of Nature. The exhibit, which will visit at least 82 public, academic, and medical libraries across the country between now and December 2005, examines Mary Shelley's classic novel and its evolution in literature, popular culture, and scientific research since its publication in 1818. The exhibit is based on a larger exhibit, which was created by and shown at the National Library of Medicine in Bethesda, Maryland, in 1997 and 1998. The traveling exhibit maintains many of the larger exhibit's themes, including the transformation of the monster from Shelley's rational and articulate creature to the speechless murderer of later plays and films. One major theme of the exhibit is how the story has been used to express society's fears about the consequences of scientific advances, which challenge our traditional understanding of what it means to be human. For a schedule of where the exhibit will be appearing, go to the American Library Association's website, ala.org, and search for Frankenstein.
That's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. We welcome your comments or suggestions, either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. And you can learn more about the OEH and Talking History at oeh.org. Until next time, this is your host.
It's moving. It's alive.